All right, Alexander, let's talk about the Victory Day. Let's start there with the Victory Day parade in Russia, in all the cities of Russia. We could talk about the Victory Day parade in Moscow because Putin did give an interesting speech. I'll read a quote from that in a bit. We could also talk about the events and the commemorations that were taking place over the weekend in Europe. And their reaction to the events that took place during World War II and how they're going about it vis-a-vis their treatment of Russia. And what else? And we could do an update on what's going on in Ukraine as well, what's going on the ground. First, let me just read you an excerpt from Putin's speech. And I think it kind of shows the difference between how Russia is approaching the World War II events and how and you'll get into how the Europeans have been approaching the World War II events. So Putin said this: "We know that American veterans who wanted to come to the parade in Moscow were actually prohibited from doing so, but I want them to know that we are proud of your exploits, your contribution to the common victory. We honor all soldiers, all the soldiers of the Allied armies, the Americans, the British, and the French, participants in the resistance, the brave soldiers and partisans of China, all those who defeated Nazism and militarism." So that is what Putin said. And just on a side note, Alexander, Putin looked healthy. He looked fine to me. What more can you say? He looked perfectly, yes. You know, in a good mood. I mean, he was there. He was present, which is a lot more than I can say for many of the times that that Sleepy Joe gives speeches. But anyway, Alexander, what do you make of everything?
Absolutely. I mean, for a man who's supposed to be dying of cancer, or is it Parkinson's disease, or who has dementia, or whatever it is that Putin is supposed to suffer from, he looked amazingly well. And he didn't look just amazingly well. I thought he came across as very strong and very confident. It was obviously one of his shorter speeches on Victory Day. And the interesting thing about it is that he had a lot of important things to say. They were not the kind of things that many people in the West had expected him to say. He'd not declared victory. He did not say anything like mission accomplished. He did not tout the fall of Mariupol or any of these kind of things. He didn't declare war on Ukraine. And of course, he didn't order general mobilization. The overall impression I got was a man determined to see the thing through, but who thinks that things are going very much his way, and who spoke in a very measured way, and who continues to reach out to the extent that he's able to the people who are able to understand him, who he feels are part of the same cause which he is fighting. And he avoids personalizing these things. Notice that he didn't speak about a single Western leader. No Western leader got named. And we're going to come to what the West says. The kind of things they say about Putin. He never reciprocates by talking about any Western leader in the same fashion. And his comments about the West in terms of World War II, about American veterans, were intended, I think, to be inclusive, reassuring, to reach out to them specifically. But there is, I think, a further point about the fact that he focused on American veterans, because, of course, there's British veterans, there's veterans of other European countries, but he specifically singled out American veterans, because I think in this he is reflecting an opinion which is gaining hold in Russia, which is that, yes, there's a debate about policy in the United States, about what the policy should be towards Russia. Yes, there is enormous hostility towards Russia there. But the United States remains an important country. The American people have consistently shown a greater understanding of Russia's concerns than some European countries do. And ultimately, I think that we're starting to see a shift in the Russian mindset, they're saying Europe, which we've long wanted to be a part of, is frankly beyond, you know, salvation. Ultimately, if we're going to establish any kind of relationship with any major Western power, it will be the United States, because the United States still has that sense of itself, of its history, of its, if you like, I'm going to say democratic traditions, which make it more open to an eventual rapprochement than anywhere in Europe does.
Yeah, contrast that with what we saw at the events in Europe. For example, just today we had the Russian ambassador in Warsaw. He was going to lay, lay flowers or a wreath onto a monument, a memorial, which I gather they do every year at this event. It's a yearly thing. And he got hit with all kinds of red paint and projectiles and all kinds of things. I mean, it got really, really ugly. And then you have stories about how in Germany they weren't allowing the Russians or the Belarusians to take part in any of the World War II events. In France, I heard similar stories, in the UK as well. What do you make of the reaction coming out of Europe?
Well, also vitriolic abuse of Putin himself, attempts to conflate him with the German leadership of the Second World War, talk about war crimes, all the kind of things, as I said, which Putin pointedly doesn't want to do. And, I mean, it seems to me that you can see again that the Europeans, the real anger, and I suspect, you know, anger is always, you know, the handmaiden of fear. The anger is in Europe. They are furious. They're angry about this thing, the way that the Russians are standing up, the way that the Russians are resisting the pressures from Europe. By the way, I should just add that one of the other things that Putin did, and this is, I think, going to rile a lot of people in Europe who read his words, is that he again made Russia's position clear on the social issues about, you know, Russia following the traditions of its of its ancestors, sticking to its traditional values, those sort of things. So again, the kind of things which, of course, the European Union, the European political class, vehemently rejects. And I think that also explains some of this anger, this splenetic anger that there is against Putin personally and against Russia in general. Because I have to say this, I mean, watching the World War II celebrations across Europe, it's difficult to know exactly who some Europeans think the enemy in World War II was, because they seem to be, they're commemorating a victory over Germany, but they seem to be talking all the time about Russia. And one gets the sense that it's the Russians who they see as the actual enemy. And of course, I have to say this, and I hope some people in Germany will understand what I mean, but I also think that in Germany, there are some people who are seeing this anti-Russian campaign as a kind of get-out-of-jail card. In other words, that the real enemy, the true enemy, is Russia. And, you know, what happened in the Second World War, well, that's all history now. We can forget about that. This commemoration today is really a commemoration of the aggression that the Russians are supposedly launching against Ukraine. And we are part of the European family, and these people, you know, in the outer regions, in the eastern regions, well, they're not.
Well, the Ukrainian ambassador in Germany pretty much said as much. He said, well, he didn't say exactly what you were saying. He said that it was Ukraine that liberated the Europeans from the Nazis. And Olaf Scholz did say exactly what you are saying. He actually said this is the Europeans fighting against the Russians, very much like it was in World War II. Yeah. I mean, he actually drew that parallel between what's going on right now between Europe and Russia and how it was the Europeans that won the day during World War II, and he failed to mention that it was the Europeans going up against Germany, and not all the Europeans, but a certain side of the Europeans going up against the other Europeans,
well, indeed,
most notably Germany. So he kind of he's messing around with history in order to do exactly what you just said.
Well, he is completely inverting history. I mean, can I just say, and I don't want to get into a debate about World War II, but I mean, you know, the Germans, when they attacked the Soviet Union, they presented it as a European crusade. And they were talking about setting up a new order in Europe and, you know, all kinds of things. So a lot of what the Germans were doing during the Second World War was presented as being a sort of Europeanist policy that Germany was following. I mean, you can be sceptical and cynical about how far the Germans meant it, but a lot of Europeans went along with it, and a lot of European countries were allied to Germany in the Second World War. Again, a fact which we tend to overlook or prefer to ignore. So I'm going to say something else. I mean, Scholz again shows an extraordinary blindness to how comments like the ones that he is making are going to be perceived in Moscow. I mean, you know, to talk in that kind of way, to say to make a speech on this day of all days, which appears to suggest that, you know, it's the Russians who are the true enemy and that the Europeans were the people who won World War II. I mean, in Russia, that isn't going to go down well at all, just as his comments about genocide when he was in Moscow went down incredibly badly. I don't know to what extent he understands this. I suspect to a great extent he doesn't. But the effect is that, as I said, it's making more and more Russians and Putin himself start to wonder, as I said, whether any kind of relationship with Europe and including Germany in the long term is possible, which brings me back to my previous points about Putin singling out the veterans from the United States, but not talking about veterans from any of the other allied countries.
Yeah, but Putin also must understand, the entire Kremlin must understand that it is, at the end of the day, the neocons and the neoliberals in the U.S. who are driving this war. So is he betting on something to change by the midterms? But, I mean, the midterms are a long, long ways away. So, you know, what exactly is he waiting for from the U.S.?
He's not betting on the midterms. He's not betting on anything changing in any short time frame. I think he's looking forward 5-10 years, probably, maybe even beyond that. He says, look, we made a huge effort after the Soviet Union fell to develop a close and good relationship with the Europeans. We thought for a time we had good relations with Germany, France, Italy even. And it turns out that it really was all a waste of time. These people fundamentally dislike us. The moment this crisis arose, their masks fell and their true opinions of us became clear. Ultimately, the United States is a country which shows that there's more debate there. Obviously, nothing is going to change in the short term. The US will continue to be the enemy in the short term. But perhaps eventually and in time, we might find some kind of modus vivendi with them. But, I mean, he's pointing to the future, not to the present. I don't think he's has any expectations that things are going to change anytime soon. So I think that was really, I want to make that very clear. If you like, it points more to disgust and frustration and indeed a loss of hope about Europe, and perhaps in time, a lingering hope that the US might eventually come round. But I don't think you should see in this any expectation of any change in policy in Washington.
All right. So Scholz did say that Putin will not win his war. His war, he said, as he was speaking about the World War II anniversary. Let's talk about what's going on the ground in Ukraine. We had the big event, and that was the fact that the Russians, and I think it is confirmed now 100%, they do have control of Popasnaya. very important city in Donbass. It breaks the first line of resistance that the Ukrainians had. The Ukrainians are very well dug in, but it looks like Russia is advancing, and they're advancing on their own terms. A lot of people are saying that it's slow, and it's too slow, and it shows that Russia just can't win, or the Ukrainians are mounting a formidable resistance. You had the events at Kharkov and Snake Island. To me, Kharkov and Snake Island was just kind of a distraction. And yeah. I'll talk about Kharkov real quick. I mean, they're making a big deal of the fact, the collective West, the media, is making a big deal of the fact that Ukraine is advancing to the north, and they may actually get to Russia's border. And I say to myself, and so what? Yeah. They get exactly. to Russia's border, then where do they go? I mean, I'm trying to understand what their thinking is. Okay, so they get to the Russian border. What is it with whatever gas they have left in the tank? Because gas is running out, petrol is running out, diesel is running out. What is it? They're supposed to mount an invasion of Russia. They can't. There's nowhere to go. They can't go to Russia. They can't go east. They can't go south. So the whole thing, Snake Island, the whole thing seems like a big distraction from what really happened in Papaznaya. And real quick, Alexander, you have a lot of think tanks. One of them is run by Bill Kristol, the neocon Bill Kristol, who pushed the Iraq war. He's a director on one of these think tanks, and they're putting out maps of how Russia is stalled and fizzling out. And I get very worried with the propaganda that they're pushing, because I see what happened today in Poland with regards to the Russian ambassador and what they threw at him. And I think to myself, these think tanks, these neocons, are tricking the people of Europe and the people of the United States, because they want them to believe that Ukraine is winning. They're not. They want them to believe that Russia is fizzling out. They're not. And they want them to believe all of this because I think the neocons want the people to buy into this narrative that, you know, if Ukraine is putting up this resistance and even winning against Russia, and they're even going to march into Russia, look at what they're doing in Kharkov, then, well, if we just send the Polish military, if we send the Romanian military, or if some U.S. soldiers step in, then it's just going to be lights out for Russia. I think this is exactly what the neocons and the neolibs, using their media machine and their propaganda, are doing. And I think this is very, very dangerous, but people are buying into it. You saw what the crowds in Poland did to the Russian ambassador. They are playing with fire, because the Russians may be going slow and may be taking great care with their actions in the East Ukraine, because I think you said it best, because they care about the Donbass and the south of Ukraine. They care about the people. They care about the infrastructure.
Yeah.
If NATO, Poland, Romania, America, the UK, if they think that they're just going to step in to this conflict and the Russians are going to take that type of care with them as well, well, then I think we're entering some very dangerous territory. I said quite a lot. What do you make of it?
I agree with every single part of what you said. Can I just say, I mean, the advance in Kharkov, apparently it's on a small numbers of men on either side. It's not a major theater of the battle. There is a Russian force there, not far from Kharkov, which is a flanking force protecting the major Russian concentrations, which are further south. And there were some positional moves. The fact that the Russians withdrew from some villages doesn't seem to me to have any real consequence. It's the work of these think tanks, the Institute of War, as it calls itself, and all of these that have been promoting these stories about Kharkov. And as for the Snake Island affair, which is very confusing, I'll be straightforward about it. A battle in which Ukraine suffered heavy losses over a piece of uninhabited rock, basically. Again, it doesn't seem to me to make a great deal of military sense. I can't help but think that the Snake Island battle was really more an attempt to seize this island for symbolic reasons in order to rain on Putin's Victory Day parade in Moscow. I mean, I can't see any other logic behind it. That's my own assessment of that particular battle. The major battles, as you absolutely rightly said, are happening in Donbass. And the fall of Papaznaya is a strong sign that Ukrainian resistance is cracking. Now, cracking, it hasn't yet cracked. We're not yet seeing a total collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Donbass. It's probably still some time away. But there's talk that now the Ukrainian forces that are holding out in these two towns of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk are now at risk of being completely encircled. There's even some talk that they may have to be that they may be pulling back, and there's growing signs that, you know, the Russians' strategy of grinding the Ukrainian defenses down is starting to pay off. Bear in mind that even Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, has admitted that the bulk of the Russian forces in Donbass have not yet even been committed to the battle. So Ukraine's suffering these huge losses. Its front lines are cracking. It's been pushed out of important places. And the Russians still have their powder dry. And I'm afraid, I think you've also summarised neocon thinking exactly right. I think that they're going to start agitating within a few days, weeks, especially when things in Donbass begin to take the inevitable direction that they're going to take, that they're going to start agitating for a Polish intervention force to be sent into Ukraine, for a new no-fly zone to be declared, for all those sort of things. Remember, Scholz has now said Putin mustn't win. Others have
talked about it. The G7 said it, actually.
The G7 said it, yeah. Exactly. So if he is going to win, what do they do? I mean, economic sanctions haven't worked. Are you going to, the only way it seems to me that you can stop him winning, if his forces are advancing and the Ukrainian troops are encircled, is, well, the only way you can do it is by intervening in Ukraine militarily. So I completely agree with you. It is extremely dangerous, and those dangers are growing all the time.
Yeah, and I was looking at a poll just yesterday as to how the populations in Europe and different countries view the war and who's at fault. And the two top countries that did not see Russia as completely at fault and saw most of the fault falling on NATO, the U.S., those countries were Bulgaria and Greece, I believe, were the two top countries there. The rest of the countries in Europe, the Baltic states, of course, Poland, Romania, many countries in central to south west Europe, they saw the fault squarely on Russia. And seeing the video today once again of what happened to the Russian ambassador in Warsaw, they've got buy-in. I think the neocons, if they don't have it 100%, they're like at 95%. Buy-in from the populations in Europe for them to say, yeah, let's go in, let's go into Ukraine because we can win this, and that's exactly what the neocons want, and I think they've got the population buy-in.
I completely agree, and I think that's the danger, and I mean that is the very, very great danger. Well, you've got weak leaders like Scholz who talks like he's just done, and fanatical individuals like Ursula von der Leyen and Annalena Baerbock in Germany and all the rest, all the more so as bear in mind that European leaders have bet the entire house on defeating Putin in Ukraine. So, I mean, it's, you know, we're now getting more and more mounting economic news across Europe. The CEO of Bosch in Germany has now come out and said we're heading into a massive crisis. Christine Lagarde is telling people, you know, we don't need to worry about stagflation, which proves to you that stagflation is actually very much on the way. So, you know, given that this is so, I mean, you know, the great risk they run is that they will lose militarily in Ukraine and they will be faced with an economic crisis in a few months' time. So what do they do? Given their rhetoric, it's very difficult to retreat. And when people are trapped by their own rhetoric and are trapped in these political positions with, well, which is where the neocons want them to be, the huge risk is that there's going to escalate. So, you know, highly likely we will be seeing NATO troops. They won't be from, you know, they won't be officially NATO troops, but there'll be troops from NATO countries starting to enter Ukraine later this month. I think that's now a very strong possibility. Whether the Ukrainians will welcome them or will want to see them there is another matter. And of course, the Russians will respond in exactly the way that you've said.
So you think the Russians are not going to, because there's a lot of talk saying that the Russians are kind of, they're going to kind of let the Polish army take a chunk out of Lviv. There is that talk out there.
I know there is.
It's going to say, let them do it. But you think they're not?
I'm the only thing I can base this on, my views on, are on the kind of comments that I'm seeing the Russians say. And Putin's comments suggest to me that they won't let that happen. That, you know, if Polish troops or other Western troops or NATO troops or troops from NATO countries enter enter Ukraine, then as far as the Russians are concerned, they're enemies and their targets. And I think that's much more plausible than there's going to be any kind of partition deal done.
Yeah, Medvedev kind of hinted, I don't want to say the exact opposite, but he did kind of give a hint that, you know, well, you know, Lviv and these areas are historically yeah. Polish territory. He gave that hint. I'm not saying that he said, "Yeah, Poland, come on in," but you know, he kind of echoed what Putin said when Putin gave the speech to launch the special military operation. Putin also pretty much said that western part is historically Polish.
I think if there were negotiations, if this was agreed between Russia and Poland, well, it's conceivable that there might be a deal. But I think in the present atmosphere, you know, and bear in mind, you know, the attack on the Russian ambassador in Poland, in that event, in the event that Polish troops entered Ukraine at the moment, the Russians would see it as an act by a hostile power intervening in a war in which Russia is engaged. So I think that without some kind of understanding, of which there is no sign, between Poland and Russia, I don't think at the moment that the Russians would accept it.
Right. Okay. I wonder if there anything else that we need to discuss? Is there anything else we need to talk about? You gave a pretty interesting, you made an interesting video the other day where I think you said something that kind of resonated with me, and I was thinking about it over the weekend, which is how no one's really talking about the heavy lifting that the Donbas armies are doing in this war. And I was thinking about that with regards to what happened in Bosnia and everything going on there. And not to take anything away from the Russian military, the Chechen fighters, but it really does remind me of Syria in a way as well, where the Russians, the Iranians, they did provide a lot of air support and a lot of logistic support. But the Syrian army, you know, Assad's army did a lot of the heavy lifting and a lot of the fighting, and you know, they saved Syria. And I think there's some parallels there with Ukraine. Once again, the Russians are there, the Russian military is there, they're operating, the Chechen forces are operating, and the Donbas is operating, but not many people talk about the Donbas militia and their performance.
Well, they don't talk about it at all. And, you know, if you come back to get what the media in Britain have been saying, I mean, you won't find any references anywhere in the media. At least I haven't found any references in the media in Britain to the fact, as I said, that the Ukrainians pulled out of Popasnaya. Nor will you find any admission, hardly any admission, that the Donbas militias are involved in the war. I mean, you know, in Popasnaya, as we both know, it was the Donbas militia that has played the biggest role. I mean, there are Chechen fighters there. There's supposedly fighters of this very dodgy, and I don't particularly like it, Wagner outfit. But most of the fighters there have been from the Donbas militia. This is their victory. actually. But as I said, you will never find any admission about this anywhere in any of the discussions about the war that take place in the West. It's purely Russia versus Ukraine. Ukraine, you know, getting some help from the West, but no real recognition of the extent to which, in some respects, this is still a war between the Donbass, the militias of the Donbass, and Ukraine, and, if you like, an evolution of the civil war that broke out in Ukraine in 2014.
Yeah, Putin recognizes it. He mentioned the Donbass fighters in his Victory Day speech.
Absolutely. All right, and your point about Syria, by the way, is absolutely valid. I mean, in Syria, the Russians provided air support, logistical support, weapon systems, training, intelligence, command and control. But it was the Syrian army that did most of the actual ground fighting. And at the moment in Donbass, I think the parallels that you made are absolutely very striking.
All right. We will leave it there, everybody. TheDurant.locals.com and The Durant Shop. Use the code GOODDAY. Get 10% off all merchandise. There's the Good Day mug. Take care.